It is continuing with David Edge on 10th August 76. About the quasars, the Cambridge...
Yes, it's just that when the very first result came through, the Cambridge people do say it didn't really jolt them all that much because, you know, in the Baconian lecture there is always a possibility of a small number of sources being in the galaxy, a proportion. So when one comes through that looks like a star in the galaxy, people don't really take off. But I'm not myself convinced that the reception was as phlegmatic as that.
Yeah, yeah.
And although I suppose after a few days' reflection they would say that, the initial information coming to them must have been slightly surprising.
Startling.
It must have made them think slightly.
Yeah.
But stars is what's in the title of my thesis, and that, remember, is 1959.
Right, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see, the first paper I had that you actually were involved in was Baldwin and Edge, in which
you
did a couple observations of Tycho's and Kepler's supernovae.
That's right.
Can you tell me about how you got involved
with that?
Well,
it was just that we were starting to get results off the actual survey itself, and I was beginning to get my stars on the graph paper. And the question of looking for remnants of supernovae, of course, has always, right through the 50s, and nobody in supernovae was an important thing,
right.
I mean, after Cassiopeia.
And John Baldwin. That's right.
And that's right. And Martin just said, well, look, we've got some 3C results now, and we've got some positions. So I just provided some information, and John said, let's put something together, and so we put it together.
So these were a couple of 3C sources that you had?
That's right.
With measured size.
Well, you'll see that the actual paper itself, which I've got here, shows Hanbury, Brown, and Hazard's position, the 2C position, and we had our own observations that we were able to add, and we got a nice few nice graphs with tables and with pictures on, you know, the observations. And it was just a simple question.
So it was not a separate project from the 3C?
No, it was just followed on from the material.
Okay. Now, can you tell me a little bit about the Sputnik days as you saw them?
Well, when you were saying, by the way, could I just say one or two things? I've just realized that when I said the first 3C results were Paris Symposium, that's not true, because we rushed through a paper which was an attempt to meet criticisms of the cosmological implications of 2C through, and it was received, here you see.
That Ed Scheuer and Shakespeare.
That's right, that's received. And when you said, commenting on my draft of the book, that we put Christmas Eve, it actually does say, received 1957, December 24th. So it's not personal involvement that allowed me to say that. It was received on Christmas Eve. And I can remember that it was a very intense few days getting it together and getting off. And that was the first 3C evidence put together.
This was published in 58.
It was published in 58.
Submitted at the end of
57. That's right.
So that was, the Paris Symposium was the following summer.
That's right.
So what was the gist of this?
This was an attempt to confirm some of the statistical results of the 2C with the 3C, and it was here and there. I mean, we were quite frank that a number of the source positions of 2C weren't confirmed in 3C. So, as it were, we were doing an internal check of our own methodology. The 2C survey was nearly 2,000 sources, and by simple factors, doubling the frequency, we should have had, as you know, 8,000 sources, and we only had 471, or whatever it was, 472. Yeah. And I remember that one of the reasons that Martin didn't supervise me very closely was that as soon as it became clear that the order of number of sources in the 3C catalogue coming out of my analysis was going to be the order of 500 and not 8,000, that he suddenly just didn't get interested any longer and was off designing the Lord's Bridge telescope, putting all his effort into that, because he knew that was going to be the next one that produced the real goods. And there was a general feeling that 3C was worth doing. It was going to be a pretty good catalogue. It was going to be a small one, and it might be a sort of dead end, and what we needed was the new technique in that, developing computing and aperture synthesis and all that, and I wasn't in, of course, with Johnny Bly. So that's item one. And so the other thing about independent projects, I mean, you mentioned the little paper in the observatory arose out of the 3C thing. I did nothing else but the straight survey. I was going to have a chapter in the thesis which was the calibration of the survey. This was partly because of the trouble that George Whitfield had calibrating his spectral paper, which led to the error, which led to the apology at the Paris Symposium, which led Minkowski to the rather sharp remark about, you know, well, we've had factors of two banded here and there, and what the hell do you think the radio astronomers are up to? So I was going to set up a standard dipole and calibrate it very carefully. I had extreme difficulty getting the thing to work properly, largely because of reflecting screens, I remember. I had it set on an aluminium sheet in the middle and then becoming a screen with wire. And I had great difficulty ensuring that the contacts of the wire to the aluminium screen were perfect. And it didn't reproduce, its matching was very difficult to do, and it didn't reproduce properly. And I'd match it, or think I'd matched it, and then come back and it was mismatched again. And I had endless trouble with this and tried to get various people to assist me without any success. And when I struggled with it for 2 or 3 months to set it up and was beginning to get some readings, then the horse broke through the fence from the field next door and ploughed right through it. And at this point, my spirit gave out, and the thought of trying to get it working again.
So
that's right. So I never got any results out of that tiny experiment. I didn't have that chapter, and the absolute calibration was never done.
Mm-hmm. What did I ask you? Oh, the business about...
Yeah.
What was that monthly notices paper the first time that the Cambridge Group, at least in print, said that there were some things wrong in 2C?
I would need to go back carefully and check. I have the abstract here, so one can... a comparison, that's right. Comparison of individual sources shows that about 1/4 of those in the previous survey are confirmed. But for the third weaker ones, the reliability is worse than was indicated. Comparison between the new positions and those found by Mills and Slee indicates fair agreement for sources with flux density more than 20 units. Poor agreement. You know, simple plot of log in, log s came down. Then it said an argument may be devised to show that the 159 megacycle observations, when taken together with the previous results at 81.5, that is on the statistical P of D analysis, taking the two together, are inconsistent with the uniform distribution. That is to say, the simplest interpretation is that there's a deficiency in the stronger sources. And this is, of course, where the hole in the universe comes from.
Right.
You would say it's basically uniform, but there's a hole. And the hole gets bigger than one. This result is, however, based on data of which the statistical significance is not sufficiently great to be conclusive in further observations. So it was a retraction on individual on the catalogue, saying that it would have been overclaimed, and something of a retraction on some of the statistical.
But certainly although the PFD, on the fact that steady state did not look good.
The P of D was always thought to be the strongest test. Log n log s was nice, but the P of D, which went right down into the noise and gave you very clear curves from a very clear prediction, from a very clear model, which you could get at, it was always felt that the P of D, although it might be much more limited in scope, was much sharper. And if the P of D of the 2C and 3C could be reconciled, and both of these together seemed to show the state, then the cosmological conclusion was maintained.
Right.
So the feeling in the group quite strongly was that that approach was not so much vindicated, but we could use that argument to keep the show going. And that's what we did, of course. Although, I must confess, Peter Shoyer had misgivings at about this time as to how much you could legitimately deduce from PFD. He really was, I think, somewhat worried about the status of it. And Martin Ryle was always for giving it more emphasis and Peter for less.
Mm-hmm.
And although I was never actually party to an outright discussion between the two on this matter, there's no secret of the fact that there were these differences of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that Peter's caution was somewhat overruled at some stages, although he allowed himself to be an author of this paper, which is a very cautious one. And when eventually Peter Shoyer went off to Australia for 2 years, I was not surprised. They all deny that these differences between Peter and Martin led to or were a factor in the decision for him to go. But it was quite clear that there was a parting of ways of some kind.
What were the nature of his reservations? I was also going to ask, why was PFD not accepted outside of Cambridge?
Yes, the nature of Peter's reservations, well, the major debate was over the extent in which diameters would make a difference and the extent of diameter, how big the diameters were and how serious the problem was. And I guess there was a straight difference of opinion over the facts of the case on that. But there are various other things that I suppose, you have to ask Peter Shoyer this, and I'm guessing, that the actual argument was over things like, well, there were debates, as I remember, about how wide the relativistic models, what sort of parameters you could get in a relativistic model, how much this made a difference.
John S. was in on that, so it's not my pigeon at all. The major debate was over diameters. And at this time, it was becoming clear the 3C diameter material was handled by Simon Archer, whom I mentioned to you before the tape recorder began. And I think it was becoming clear that his data was not to be taken all that seriously, and therefore there was a further argument about how much his diameter statistics were reliable. And also, this is just hypothesizing, that Peter was now engaged in the sheer business of converting the aerial array again to 408 megacycles with John Haesler, and I think it was becoming clearer to Peter the sheer experimental difficulties of getting records out of this kind of thing, and therefore, you know, the kind of thing that Martin was always accusing Fred Hoyle of, that Fred Hoyle didn't know how difficult the experimental data was. Peter was discovering how difficult it was to get experimental data, and was beginning
so
to wonder.
So he became cautious in his...
So he became, well, he became pretty gloomy, actually. Mm. And partly that was the external challenge. And I think these things were tending to add up to a difficulty of really putting his finger on precisely how far he wanted to say the PFD could be relied on to do certain clear things.
You say Archer did the diameters. Do you have diameters in your thesis?
There are diameters in the thesis. I measured no diameters. The diameters are measured with a different combination of the four elements, differently phased, and have different records.
I see.
And we had runs of the straight point source survey, which I handled, and further runs, which Simon Archer handled, with John Baldwin, I think, looking over his shoulder up to a point, which he then took away up the attic and analysed in his own way. And then there was also Bruce McAdam, who was doing the high declination, where the frequency of the lobe pattern gets very, very complicated. And he was integrating signals artificially with a sort of special brass switching system which he devised. And he handled the small number of sources that came in off that part of the sky. So the analysis consists of the basic positions plus one or two large diameter sources, which I couldn't see on the point source survey, well, when I say one or two, 20 or 30, which Simon Archer produced the basic positions for, and intensities for, plus some diameter measurements added to my sources, which Simon Archer produced, plus the sources from the high declination, which Bruce McAdam produced, which were checked out with my raw, unsmoothed records. And the catalogue was compiled in that way.
So that explains all the co-authors, in fact. Was it also primarily the extended sources that were bothering outside people?
The extended sources. You'll see that in the discussions in the various symposia. Yes. Mills was consistently attacking on this score, was consistently trying to get information about more extended sources. I can remember actually being in my office on my white Formica sheet top when Mills came to Cambridge. Now, this must have been either just before or just after the Paris Symposium. I'm not really sure which.
Yeah.
And Martin Ryle came in, and we had some 3C records, and we had some 3C, not only my records, but diameter records, which show variable background and have the fringes, you know, with wobbling up and down in bumps. And we had some of Mills's records. He brought some of his own records. And we put them side by side. And Martin said, look, you say there's a large diameter source there. It's not there, says he, looking at Mills' record. Mills would pick the record up, look carefully along it, and say, ah, but if you look from this angle, you'll see there's a bump, you see. And Martin would pick it up, and testily sort of look along, and say, well, yeah, but it's not a real thing, you know. It's just a, you know, it's just a pen wander slightly, you see. And I can remember quite vividly that this was the form of the argument. It was totally unresolvable, because Mills would look at his record.
Intended.
Well, that's right. In this, Mills would look at his records and would see these large diameter sources, and Martin would look at his records and not see them, and look at our records and not see them, and say, and even if there is this sort of bump and it's statistically significant as you claim, it clearly isn't a real thing. And that happened in my office on my white Formica top, and was, I think, the only time in this period when Martin and Bernie Mills actually got together seriously to look at records and say, what the hell's the difference?
But why did Ryle never become interested in maybe getting a hold of some dish and, you know, looking for extensions?
Well, hold it. The 2C and the 3C were designed for this, as Martin will continually point out. There were three arrangements. There was the full thing for small diameter sources, which was the 2C survey basically and the 3C survey. There was then the diameter measures, which got the interim diameters, ones that were big enough in diameter to produce a reduction in intensity on the full survey, but still small enough to get fringes.
Right.
And that, those you could measure and put limits on.
Partially
and then you ran the thing basically as a simple pencil beam, fully filled aperture. And that picked up the major large, really large diameter ones, which you could then see as a pencil beam survey. And that was cleverly designed so that these three arrangements would cover the span.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons Martin resisted the idea that diameters were sufficiently important to affect the statistics because of the evidence we got off our own instrument of diameters. We had done our own search for diameters for these large sources, and we didn't find them in the way that Mills appeared to find them. And that remained right through into the early 60s, an unresolved difference which eventually just disappeared. Peter Scheuer did some work on this and published papers eventually in from Sydney with the first runs of the Parkes dish, which showed that most of what Mills called extended sources turned out to be complex mixtures. Or, of course, there was always this curious phrase that they were irregularities in the background radiation, which is a metaphysical way of explaining them away. I mean, how do you distinguish between irregularity in background radiation and the real thing? That's right. But this was at the moment that, although that sort of metaphysical argument was always going on in the background, we had our data, which included an estimate of diameters, and that estimate convinced us, with Peter not entirely clear, but most of the others fairly clear, that the corrections for diameter and POD were realistic, whereas Mills, with his type of survey, with his cross, and eventually, of course, using his cross as one element in an interferometer to look also for diameters in the intermediate area, he had come up with evidence that convinced him that the diameters were more extensive and more important. And these two went on in invincible ignorance. I mean, the two were just convinced by their own. And when they did look and cross-correlate on the records, and Martin looked at Burney's and Burney looked at ours, they saw what it was they, you might say, predisposed to see. You better not reproduce that, because Martin will go through the roof. But, I mean, there was that kind of difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And it went on. And it went on for some time after I left, too. And it was, as Peter Scheuer said in an interview with us, well, it wasn't really resolved, it just disappeared. Just disappeared. Okay?
Yes. Very useful. I gather that you were wholly in accord with the Cambridge spirit and so forth.
Oh yes, it was marvelous. I mean, all the young graduate students, you know, it was like supporting a successful team.
Yeah.
We weren't the cheerleaders, but we were the people who were providing all the necessary basic information
right.
and feeding it upstairs. And when Martin Ryle had his measles and was lying in bed writing the Bakerian lecture, we were all summoned.
Yes. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, he was invited to give the Bakerian lecture and decided to give an overall survey on astrophysics and what was known about radio sources, including all the cosmological things and also all the detailed astrophysics, so you could put it together into a coherent picture. And he doodled out a marvellous graph with the whole of the universe on log-log scale.
Right.
Terrific thing. We were all boggled at it. And he put on it limits to where the things could be by various estimates of various things. And he brought people in from time to time to do jobs on it. I mean, it suggested him, for instance...
Well, he got the measles, you say.
He got the measles and was lying at home, yes. So we were all summoned and went and sat in his bedroom and got instructions and went away and then came back with what work we'd done. And I remember particularly Peter Scheuer was summoned to do some mathematics because Martin had worked out, I mean, he constructed this whole log-log curve, this huge Bakerian lecture curve, on the simple assumption that all radio sources, wherever they may be, had a constant intensity. I mean, he just worked out an absolute intensity and put it in the model. And he got, unfortunately, a few areas where it was conceivable you might have some whole sources lurking. They hadn't eliminated all the areas. And then it had struck him that if you put an intensity spread in, the limits might be different, and you'd eliminate these unfortunate holes in the galaxy where they might conceivably be. So he'd done a very crude model and had put a third of the sources with a 10th I and a third with I and a third with 10 I or something like this, mm-hmm. and done a crude algebraic summation of this, and discovered that this did remove the offending areas, and so he was very pleased that he had, as it were, grasped the physical reality of the model.
Right.
And then he summoned in Peter Scheuer, and Peter Scheuer's job was to put it all in proper intervals and do the calculus properly, and a week later Peter came down having dutifully gone through the mathematics and gave him a nice-looking, fully finished proof. And again, Martin Weyl wanted a good summary of what was known in terms of radio galaxies and optical identifications, and I had been working and corresponding with David Dewhurst, who'd been over in California, and we had got a lot of notes, and it was, I had a whole chapter of the thesis, was putting all that together. So I produced a table, which was a table of those in the Vickerian lecture, which summarized all the ones that were well established, and I got in my £5 book token for that out of the lecture.
That's right.
We all got little cuts of the fee. And it was marvellous. I mean, you really were engaged in it, and you felt like that.
It was the whole Cambridge group that gave this Vickerian lecture, in a sense.
Well,
I mean, with Ryle, obviously.
Yes, Ryle coordinated and orchestrated it and had the basic ideas. I mean, his idea was that he could put it all together, and then everybody came in and gave the little pieces. And one feeling was the graduate students were basically cut off from the friction. We got hints of it, but we never went to the conferences and got rudely assaulted.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't see the kind of correspondence that Martin Rahn might well have been carrying on with other people. We never sort of were in on the...
Yeah, privy to,
we weren't with the governing body. You know, when the proofs of Mills and Slee's first paper came through to Cambridge before publication, we weren't actually in on the reading of it. We heard that it had happened and that some of the words in footnotes, like, you know, Ryle and Shaw purport to show it got annoyed and were being altered in the final version and so on.
Yes, you're telling me that these proofs had stronger language than the final version.
That is what I can remember actually seeing. The galley proof, and there was a footnote, Ryle and Shaw of 1957 or whatever it was, purport to show, and that you'll find not in the final version. And I do remember we got sort of hints of all this. And we knew, you know, intensive discussions were going on round and round and round what you could get cosmologically out of the statistics, and we all were in and heard this and made our own contributions as much as we could, although most of the argument was done at the higher level and we hadn't much more to say. But we were somewhat insulated, and we had our own little bits of the game and we were getting on with it. And there was a tremendous sense in which we were all contributing to something, which clearly was adding up,
adding up
excitingly, and therefore we were in on in that kind of way. Now, when you ask, did we all agree with the Cambridge position? Well, mark you, I was working on 3C survey, and I had very rapidly formed my own conclusions as to how ropey the 2C survey was. And they were not flattering. I mean, I really do believe, I felt the 2C survey as a survey, as a catalogue, was pretty well a sham. So
but you had to be pretty careful about that.
So in that respect, I mean, I clearly
saying this,
was, you might... thought ripe for standing right outside and saying the whole thing won't work. But of course everybody knew the 2C catalogue had been discredited and everybody accepted, and John S. was sitting gloomily in a corner wondering what the hell to do next, because I mean it had hit him very hard.
Well, how did this realisation come about, really?
Well, as soon as Mills started challenging and said, my instrument doesn't check them, and as soon as the very first 3C things came through...
It was only when Mills first began to publish his results.
Well, I guess that the...
There were no reservations before then, that someone said, oh my God...
Now, hold really it, because hurt. Mills started saying he couldn't reproduce it pretty early on. In the 1955 Jodrell Bank Symposium, he had some preliminary results. Even that early, you'll find Mills, with the first runs with the cross, saying it doesn't seem to fit. So even at the time which I joined, it was beginning to become clear that there may be criticism building up. But as soon as we got the first 3C things, I did my first tracings, I actually put on the 2C source positions, corrected back to raw data, and put on the thing, and immediately it was clear that the thing wouldn't work.
Yeah. And what was the time span of the 3C observations?
When did I start analysing in this way? It must have been late 50, it must have been summer to autumn 56 that we started getting records off the 3C. And I started trying out this. The only way I could check that would be, and it'd probably be too late, would be go back to the accounts of the Cavendish and find out when I bought the white formica top for the table, which is when I started doing it.
But what was it that convinced the Cambridge group that 2C, even though some of them would not admit it, was bad? Mills, certainly not just Mills saying that he wasn't going to agree with that.
As soon as the 3C records came through and it was clear that when Mills said these 2C sources do not exist, 3C was also going to say they do not exist. At that point, the very first samples, the very first things, it became clear that the 2C catalogue was a write-off.
So what you would say then is that Mills' early results produced some doubts.
Oh yes, certainly.
But most of the people at Cambridge were not convinced that 2C was wrong until 3C.
Well, I'm guessing here, but I think probably John Shakeshaft would, having actually himself been involved directly in the analysis of 2C, would have been thinking that he'd overstretched it before 3C results came in, I think.
Yeah. Well, I can ask him that.
You can ask him that, and I don't know whether he'll remember. But it was. The point is, it did not take long for the Cambridge group to realise that the 2C catalogue they would have to discredit. On the other hand, with log n log s, of course, also goes with a good deal of the catalogue, although the first log n log s is from 3C, the proper ones, not my first sketch, which had to be corrected, but the first ones that came up looked as if they were going to be on the steeper side than Mills and Slee and Hill were getting, and therefore we felt there was still a case we could probably mount there. But it was always, and always, the P of D, which always looked nice, which kept the whole show together.
Did P of D come along as a response to Mills's objections?
No.
That was part of
no.
the scheme all
no.
along?
No, it wasn't. You'll find Peter Scheuer will tell you about this. It just simply happened that as soon as the 2C results began to come off, Martin said, look, we're going to get nice statistics. We did the first log n log s, which actually was Graham Smith did the first log n log s on the 1C survey in his thesis, and that was a thinking they were all in the galaxy mm-hmm. at that time. But there is a log n log s plot.
Right.
And so the sort of idea of doing log s on log s plots was planted early on, and as soon as the first 2C samples came through the log n log s, my goodness, it goes through the roof. And Martin immediately said, well, there is no way you can explain this away, and so he was cooking up his Halley lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And of course this was being discussed in the group. And then it occurred to Peter Scheuer, in one of these discussions, that you would do a statistical analysis on the raw deflections, and this would be able to check out certain quite simple models. And so people, you know, the people said, oh, that's a good idea, Peter, go away and think about it. And so he went away and thought about it as something it could be done on these interferometer records. And as Peter says, you know, he independently rediscovered several well-known statistical laws independently. And then Mr. Ratcliffe, didn't like the way he handled Fourier's when he wrote it all up, said, go to see so-and-so. It wasn't Wilkes, somebody else in the computing lab. And the chap looked over and said, oh, there's nothing much in this, but there's a much more relevant proof you can use of the following. So Peter went away suitably chastened and used a more relevant proof. But it arose out of thinking about statistics and Peter himself. It wasn't in the original plan. It wasn't something that was in the design of the telescope.
But it wasn't in response to Mills either.
And it wasn't in response to Mills, and it wasn't in response to anything. It was just that people were beginning
to
see.
That's
right. That's right. But exploiting the fact that, as we pointed out to me, that when the 2C survey ran, it suddenly became. It was much more confusion limited than they expected. And as John Shakeshaft argues, that's because the universe is more congregated at the far edges than people thought. And so they were taken aback by this, and as soon as they saw they were getting lovely jumble records, then the thought immediately occurred that you could do statistical analysis of these and check out directly. So it arose, as it were, as the thing unfolded.
Right.
But it wasn't a response to anything else.
Why did P of D end up getting published in an obscure journal like the Cambridge Philosophical Society?
Well, now, that's an interesting point. For one thing, Peter took a long time to write it up properly, partly because he went off to do his army service.
Yeah.
But I am told, although I was not party to it, that they did try to get it published in Phil Mag. I don't think they tried Prof. Roy Sock, but you better ask. But they certainly tried Phil Mag, and Phil Mag had previously published a paper by John Shakeshaft, which was the first cosmological paper from Cambridge, published in 1954, I think, which was a sort of simple models of distribution of galaxies and sources in the universe. And so Phil Mag were, as it were, not averse to publishing that kind of paper, but they turned it down, presumably because it was refereed somewhere by somebody. And eventually what happened was that Peter did give the paper in person to the Philosophical Society of Cambridge, and proceedings of the Cambridge Philosophical Society took it. And it is, you're quite right, it is a rather more obscure journal. And that's a combination of the fact that at least one less obscure journal had turned it down, plus the fact that he had given the paper to the society and therefore the proceeding would take it. And those two things together eventually transpired, it came out there.
Okay.
But you could do further probing on that. We asked this question directly, and there was a certain amount of suspicion, and that would be 56, 57, if that's right.
You've told me before, could you repeat now just the story about when Oort came and gave a cloaking.
That's right.
Yes,
Oort came and gave a symposium on the Crab Nebula, which was a main. It was 56 or 57, I think. 57.
Right.
It was one of a regular series of Cavendish symposia. And it was basically about his polarization studies, both optical and radio, with a good deal of very pretty illustration, as you know. I mean, that work is really staggering.
Well, he had these beautiful plates.
Oh, marvelous. Yeah. I mean, and so it was a visual display, which was very impressive. But not only that, or talked about theoretical terms about what you could make of relativistic vectors. The synchrotron theory, as you know by then, was very well established, and that was deployed with great interest and so on. And he used in his lovely broken English phrases like, you know, the electrons have not the eternal life, and this sort of thing, and it made it spice it up. And I happened to be sitting next to Martin Ryle, who made copious notes and gave many sort of expressions of satisfaction as the lecture proceeded. And at the end of it, put down his pencil with a great sigh of satisfaction, said, my goodness, this chap's worth listening to. He really, you know, he really gets stuff out of him. He's got ideas. And when we interviewed Ryle, Ryle said one of the important things was that Oort had tacit knowledge, that, you know, it wasn't all written up. He, as it were, came with a lot of sort of inbuilt stuff that you'd never get out of papers.
Yes.
And so that was a very important seminar for the group, because they really did get a lot of their ideas. And so Harriet Tubman had been recruited to do work on synchrotron theory.
Indeed, that's right.
But Harriet was brought in as a theorist to develop some of these theoretical notions in relation to supernova remnants and the supergalaxy and the galactic halo and so on. And so it was all part of the developing theoretical scene. And I remember Martin really, really enjoyed that. And in fact, it was a marvelous seminar.
I have a couple other anecdotes that I'd like you to tell.
Could you tell me what's your favorite 3C source?
Oh, yeah, well,
and why?
Communing with my graft, I used to love some of the sources really looked so nice. They fitted together so beautifully. They were so clear, and all the intensity observations all fitted nicely. And one of those I particularly liked, and it really did look like nice on the paper, was 3C273. And I mean, this was entirely innocent. I mean, we had no idea what 3C273 was going to give rise to. But one of the reasons I liked it was because in the Methodist hymn book, number 3C273 is Come Down, O Love Divine, to the tune of Down Ampney, which is a Vaughan Williams tune, which is a lovely tune. And it's a beautiful hymn. And I was particularly fond of that source, partly for that reason. The Methodist minister at Cambridge during that period, my graduate period, Arnold Morris, was a great cricket fan. And he used to tell you, as you were going into Fenner's to watch the cricket, you asked Arnold, who's coming out, what's the score? And he used to tell you how the game had gone by using the sections of the Methodist hymn book, which, you know, are named by various things. They went slowly through his life, work, and mission, you know, but they speeded up through repentance and so on. And so the notion of sort of using the Methodist hymn book in this way, after all, it has a large number of hymns, was one that I particularly liked anyway.
What were some of the other sources that, can you remember?
Well, do you know, I'm not entirely sure, because when they started coming out as quasars, I was then working at the BBC. I went back to my thesis, and you'll find that there are, in fact, notes within the thesis. I have little scribbled notes, which I made just for fun to keep myself up to date. And I can remember 3C48. Well, 3C48, as I recall, was a really undistinguished source of what the hell it was doing, you know.
Yeah.
And 3C9 was absolutely... No, 3C9 was, in fact, an A source. And so, but 4C48, let me just check. 48 was also a starred source. But there were one or two... 47 47 to start. No, there were one or two others I looked up, and they were miserable things. We used to have a classification. You called it an A if you'd extracted it without making any allowance for confusion. If it had looked sufficiently outstanding on the paper that you didn't have to allow for confusion with the external source, you'd just taken it plain off the thing, it was an A source.
Yeah.
But if it had been particularly clear and really looked very nice, you starred it. So you have A and starred A. Now the quasars, 3C9 was an A but not a starred A, and was a relatively weak one, so that I was a bit surprised about.
Mm-hmm.
47 and 48 were starred A's, that's right, 147. I can remember thinking some of these were miserable, and I was really surprised. 47 was a starred A, and 147 was a starred A. 196 was a starred A, 216 was a starred A. So these were all, in a sense, you know, what one expected, but I had no fondness for these numbers in the way I had a fondness for 245. Let me just check it out. This 245 was an A, but not starred, and was only 12 intensity units, and as I recall, was a pretty miserable thing. Now 273, you see, comes along. 273, there it is. Now 273 was starred B. That's right. Yes, I remember that. I remember now. Sorry, I revised my memory on looking at this. The reason I particularly liked 2C273 was that it had been confused with another one several lobes away, and I had done a vector analysis. You work in from the outside, yeah, getting a first estimate, and then work into the confused center and start subtracting one from the complex thing. And when I'd done this analysis, which is a fairly complicated thing to do in detail, when I put 2C273 together, it fitted beautifully.
Everything
came together. Yeah. With a very small range of... In fact, I think we had to increase the stated error of 273. No, we didn't. We didn't increase the stated error of it, either in declination or in intensity, but it still looked very nice. So it was a starred B. Okay. And from my point of view, a starred B was nice because it was starred and because it was a triumph of my...
Something that you had to work for.
That's right, yeah. I had to work for, yes. And 286 was another starred B, but I can't remember actually being very fond of that. But that was a quasar one.
Something we haven't explicitly talked about is your comparison of the 3C with the Mills.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you basically find there?
Well, I found the more intense sources were pretty reliable. I mean, we checked out almost one for one 3C with MSH over, I think it was 15 flux units or something like that. But once one started getting down into the ones which in Mills records were pretty ill-defined humps, I did reproduce in the thesis, and here we are. This is Mills' raw data, and this was how he plotted. You got these points and drew the line.
This came from one of his papers?
That's right, it came from one of his papers. Well, now, these things look pretty good, and they, in fact, came out in 3C. But when you started seeing humps of that kind, it began suddenly to go random. And so you had this fairly clear divide around, as I remember, 15 flux units on our sort. I can't remember if it was 20 on his. Where above that, things checked out pretty closely, and below that, it began to go random pretty quickly.
So it sounds like you're saying that the 3C showed that both 2C and MSH were reaching too far.
Well, indeed. Indeed, I mean, as David Hewer summed it up, there were errors on both sides.
Right. 2C in perhaps a bit more than MSH.
Well, 2C was making too confident a claim that it could sort out the confused records, and Mills was taking too confident a claim that he could see things down among the grout. I mean, he was sensitivity limited. And in both cases, there was an overstretching, yes.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I mean, everybody at Cambridge would agree with that.
Yeah.
And whether Mills would particularly agree with that, I think he must now do so. Yeah.
A couple other, not necessarily anecdotes, but can you tell about the storm blowing down the antenna and the visit of the BBC and
oh,
such?
God.
Briefly.
Oh, that was incredible. This was when the first 4C area was being built. There was one long element which was built basically on the 3C, 2C area of Parliament. That was the parabolic elements that tipped in a cylindrical paraboloid. But the tipping was done not manually but by servo motors at each tower. And the whole thing was linked together. There were cables connecting each tower and each paraboloid bit, and there was a whole miles and miles and miles of reflector wire, which had to have a quick release in case you got a freezing rainstorm and increased the weight and pulled it down. And we spent a long time discovering the frequency with which cows were encased with ice and freezing storms and this kind of thing to work out statistically how often the freezing rainstorm was likely, which would freeze enough ice on that stuff to bring in the whole aerial down. And then we devised a clever release so that the person who was on duty at the thing could just run along and pull a handle and all the wires would suddenly sag.
You say we. You were helping with this also?
Oh, yes. I mean, we felt we. It was Tony Hewish, as I remember, who experimented with quick release mechanisms. So you had a sort of bar on which all the ends of the reflector wires were, which were clamped to the final tower, and you had a handle you just pulled down that released the clamp, and then the whole of the thing sagged.
Right.
So you could take an insurance on it freezing during the night. And then if it didn't, then you just put it back up again and pull the things together, and then you were back. Well, this was all being built, and it was being built by the small team of workmen from Mackay's jobbing engineering works. And there was, as I remember, a foreman and two people who worked under him. The foreman was when we came, by the way, to have the formal dinner at Keyes for the opening of the Mullard Observatory by Sir Edward Appleton. And there was a big feast at Keyes, which was my own college, had a very good kitchen laid on a very nice feast. Martin Ryle insisted that among the formal guests who came would be the gardener at Lord's Bridge, little Joe, who had been a scout in my father's scout troop before the First World War, Fen Ditton. Marvellous character who just jobbed around, you know, keeping everything happy, I think, and was one of the team.
Yeah.
And the foreman, and I'm not at all sure the other two members of the team who put it up. And I had the great good pleasure to be sitting near to both Joe and the foreman. And they were, I think, without a doubt, the stars of the conversation during the dinner. It was marvellous. But this is part of Martin's view. I mean, the formal dinner included people.
Right. But Ryle had been using Mackay's for...
Ryle was a very close friend of Donald Mackay. From the very early days, Donald Mackay had been in on building, I think, the angle iron frames for the first 1C aerial. And he certainly built the whole of the 2C, 3C thing. And that was all done in his backyard of his engineering works. All the little bits were put together and welded by his jobbing lot. And when it came on to the first of the aerials at Lord's Bridge, Martin got the money from Mallard and insisted that he was still in charge with Donald Mackay of actually building the thing. So there was no consulting engineers, there were no contractors coming in and taking over. Martin actually supervised through the foreman exactly what went on. Now, it happened that on the Friday night of this particular weekend in 57, when the whole of all the towers and most of on the collecting cables and most of the reflecting wires, I remember, of that long half-mile cylindrical paraboloid were up, the foreman came to Martin and said, look, one of the important tensioning cables on the end, the west end tower, is not the right length. And we're having to take it away to get it adjusted, and we're putting in a temporary cable, which is too short, but we have a link of chain which we can put in to make it the right length. Now, Martin knew this had been put in, knew that it was weak, but it wasn't going to be as weak as it should have, as strong as it should have been, but reluctantly agreed that this should be done. So Martin was at home that weekend knowing that the west end of that area was badly guyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the Sunday, an extraordinary gale blew up. It was, even by English standards, an extraordinary gale. It blew directly from the west, so it blew directly, the cylindrical parallel was east-west, so it was blowing directly down the tower. It was a storm which got into the public note because it blew off, as I remember, a lot of roofs of houses that had just been built at Hatfield New Town, and there was a rumpus, and the contractors were sued because they'd only put it down with nails and so on. So it was a pretty extensive storm, and it had a lot of damage. Now, this blew through the Sunday night, and I can remember afterwards people saying, who'd been up to the Grange Road site, which is by Martin Ryle's house, that when they cycled back in the early hours of the morning, they could see that the light was on in Martin's bedroom. Now, John Thompson was doing some experiments out at Lord's Bridge and was staying overnight at Lord's Bridge, and he had to get up regularly and go out and correct and check things. And, of course, during the night he went out and did it and didn't notice anything. Pretty battling through the storm, but he did it. Now, as soon as the dawn broke, about 5 o'clock, he went out to check up something on one of his arrays, and he looked around and said, there's something odd. And the thing that was odd was that the actual line of parallels, like a line of trees, the west tower had gone down, and over half the towers were absolutely flat. The east tower was still standing, and some of the paraboloid elements near to it were relatively vertical. But all the rest was a shambles, and they'd all hit each other and fallen down. And there was just a general mess. It really was a mess.
Mm.
And John Thompson looked absolutely unbelievingly at this and said, my God, what do I do? And so his first thought was he phoned Martin. This was 5 o'clock in the morning, right, or thereabouts. And so he dialed Martin's number, and in British phones, the dialing term is two rings, ring, 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 ring. Mm. And the first two hadn't got out, only the first one, and the phone was off the hook because Martin was waiting by the phone. He'd been up all night expecting the call.
Mm.
So there was a real to-do. I was at home, at my family home on Huntington Road. About 9 o'clock, I was phoned by John Baldwin, who said, look, you know the gale blew out in the night, it's blown the aerial down. We're all going out to help as we can. Martin's in a terrible state. Come out as quickly as you can. As I recall, I got on the bicycle and I might have got the transport, but I think I went out by bike. And there was Martin with his wife, who'd come along specially to keep people away from him and generally try to console him, standing in the midst of this absolute shambles. This was 9:30, 10 in the morning. You could see his sort of emotions working in his mind, working, what the hell do we do?
Right.
You know, this is putting me back a year, and what do I do? You see life's work, because Martin's work was basically nuts and bolts and engineering, building the damn things. What the hell do we do? And there was Graham Smith was there, I remember, I think Tony Hewish was there, and John B. and John S. were there, and John T. was there, and George Whitfield was around, Robin Conway probably was there as well, and we were all sort of, you know, trying to be helpful, sort of idly picking up on bits and making piles in the way you would do helplessly, trying to be useful. And it was really terrible, and it was an awful feeling about it all. And then, would you believe, a BBC film camera unit van came by and drove along the main road past Lord's Bridge and started to drive into the entrance. And Graham Smith spotted this and realised there would be terrible to do if they actually turned up too close to the arrow. He rushed down the road to the gate and stopped them as they came in the gate. And they said politely they were looking for the Grange Road site because they wanted to take some pictures of it for some programme they had in mind or something they were doing.
Was this for some radio astronomy thing?
Well, I can't